Come in, come in, come in. Pull up a chair beside the radio there. I'm just putting another log on the fire. Oh, perfect. It's that time of year again. The Mooney Goes Wild Christmas Gift Show.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire. Jack Frost nipping at your nose. Yuletide carols being sung by a choir. And folks dressed up like Eskimos.
Yes, what would Christmas be if Mooney Goes Wild wasn't here to encourage you to do the right thing and give books as gifts? In a season filled with lights, music and screens everywhere, a book is something timeless. It's more than a present. It's an experience, a moment of calm, let's say, and a spark for the imagination. So this year, more than ever, we need to help people rediscover the magic of reading from a book. Let's get those eyes off the screens for a few hours and into the pages of something wonderful. And what better way than with books about the natural world? These stories and insights open our minds to the beauty around us, reminding us why nature matters and why it needs our care. So as you wrap up your gifts this Christmas, think about adding a book to the pile, share a story, share a passion, and give a gift that lasts a lifetime. After all, nothing says Christmas like a good book and a warm fire.
I'm offering this simple phrase to kids from 1 to 92. Although it's been said many times, many ways, Merry Christmas.
Wonderful sound of Tony Better. Who better to sing Chestnuts Roasting on an Open Fire? Anyway, the format of tonight's show is very straightforward. I'll be chatting in no particular order, I hasten to add, to each of our regular contributors. They have chosen a book they think might be of interest to you or your loved one or your friend or whatever. Perfect ideas for your Christmas stockings, missus. And remember, every one of these treasures is nature related. And you'll be delighted to know that we'll also be hearing from the authors. So, shall we get started? Let's begin by turning the page on our first suggestion, which comes from Terry Flanagan. Terry!
Well, Derek, my book is Frog Roots, Polka Dot Newts and Other Treasures of Irish Nature by Anya Murray.
Oh, sounds lovely.
It's a lovely book. It's filled with incredible nuggets of information about many, many plants and animals in Ireland. And Derek, did you ever wonder why wagtails wag their tails? Or is there any such plant as shamrock? Or why are there 165 million frogs in Ireland? Well, this book answers all those questions and many more. Anya, congratulations on your book.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Tell me a little bit about it.
Well, it's Frog Roots, Polka Dot Newts and Other Treasures of Irish Nature, and it goes through month by month some of the things that people might see in Irish rivers, meadows, woodlands and the waters all around the coast. And it's not comprehensive, but there's all sorts of little quirky things happening in the natural world that often go unseen by us.
Tell me about the name of the book. It's a bit of a mouthful.
It's certainly not a short and snappy title. It rhymes, which was kind of fun. And a lot of people don't know that we have wild native newts in Ireland. So that was a fun one to include. There's so many different, there's more than 100 different pieces. It was kind of hard to find a name that encompasses all of that.
It's a wildlife book that goes through the months of the year. It's in chronological order. But you start in February. Why?
That's right, Terry. Under the old Celtic or pagan calendar, the year would start at La Fela Breida, which is the 1st of February. And that was when, in bulk, when seeds began to emerge, when the winter dormancy ended. So I thought that was a better place to start than January.
Now, the book itself, it's a treasure trove of nuggets of wildlife facts. And you start there in February. And, of course, the first thing we think of in February are the frogs.
I love frogs myself. And there was one, some of the things I found out doing it. I've always thought that frogs were introduced to Ireland by the Normans. But then more recently, with genetic analysis, they found out that frogs are actually native here. They were here from earlier in the post-glacial period.
Now, I'm not going to go through every single month of the year, but if I take March, everybody thinks of the shamrock. But there's no such plant.
St. Patrick's Day. I know, it's not the botanical name of a plant, and actually that one was prompted by a friend of mine putting up a piece saying there was shamrocks growing in his plant pot, and I knew that to be wood sorrel, which has three little leaves as well. But really, shamrock normally is some of the clovers, and we have lots of different types of clovers in Ireland, but it's not a botanical name. So I started to look into which one of these actually is a shamrock. And it isn't. Like, shamrock, it was a term that in Elizabethan England they used to use to describe the wild, savage Ireland surviving on a diet of shamrocks and milk alone. So it was kind of used derogatorily, like the shamrock eating Irish. And then there was different studies up through the centuries to see which plant corresponded with the actual shamrock. So in 1892, Nathaniel Colgan asked people all over Ireland to send in samples, and lesser clover came up as the shamrock. And then that survey was repeated again in the 1990s by Charles Nelson in the Botanic Gardens, and he found that lesser clover was also what most people sent in as the shamrock. But what I really love about the story is, like, shamrock is our national emblem of Ireland. We're so proud of the shamrock, and people all over the world love the Irish, especially in March on St. Patrick's Day. And really, it started as a derogatory, demeaning term, as these shamrock-eating Irish, these wild, savage people.
And of course, the name itself, shamrock, comes from Irish shamar og, meaning...
That's right, meaning little shamar or little clover.
So all the shamrocks that we see on St. Patrick's Day are in fact clovers.
They are.
Tell me a little bit then about strawberries.
Strawberries, or wild strawberries, are one of my favourite things about the summer. I mean, my birthday is in June. I associate that with your wandering along the hedge banks and picking and eating the delicious little wild strawberries that grow there. But then they're so tiny and super flavoursome. But really, the other amazing strawberry that we have is the strawberries that grow on trees. And this sounds like something from a fairy tale book, but we have this arbutus tree, or the strawberry tree, and that's endemic to Ireland. It's native here, but it's a very unusual tree in that it's quite rare. It only grows around Cork and Kerry and Sligo, the western seaboard, and it's not native in the UK. So it's one of these Lusitanian species that grow in Iberia and in France and Brittany and in Ireland, and they're not native to the UK. So the strawberry tree is this incredibly interesting story.
You also wrote about millipedes. Now, millipedes are animals that most people wouldn't really think twice about, but yet you tell me that they're one of your favourite, if not your favourite animal.
I do love millipedes. I mean, we know them as kids because they curl up so tightly in a little ball. But millipedes are one of those animals that they're here for a very, very long time. And they do the unglamorous job of chomping through all the dead plant matter in October. So all the leaves that have fallen off the trees and twigs, along with lots of other decomposers. But we tend not to look at them or to give them much credit as being such an important little animal, like recycling all the nutrients, the magnesium and the calcium and everything else, so that the other plants can emerge fresh in spring with all of these recycled nutrients. So yeah, I called it the millipedes, the deserving of the award for outstanding ecological importance in October.
Well, one of my favourite invertebrates as a group are the dragonflies. And walking along the canal on a late summer's evening or a September evening, you see all the different types and you talk about them in the book. They're a great animal.
They are such a beautiful creature. And, you know, they have these incredible blues and greens, and even some of them are red. One of the things that I find really fascinating about dragonflies and damselflies, though, is they spend most of their lives on the bottom of a lake in the mud as these tank-like species. Like, they're a little nymph, but they've got a hard case, they've got a massive jaw, and they chomp through all the other little invertebrates. Even tadpoles is what they eat. So there's this underwater creature with no eyes, no wings. They're dark, they're kind of... they're particularly...
ugly.
They're ugly, yeah. And then in the summertime, they emerge out onto a piece of vegetation, like reeds or rushes in the edge of the lake, and they metamorphose into these amazing creatures. So when we see them in the summer, they may only be experiencing the world in this way for the very first time. It might be their first flight where they have wings and eyes to experience the world. So, yeah, I find dragonflies and damselflies pretty fascinating.
One group of insects that we don't tend to think of as being beautiful or pretty are the moths, but we've thousands of species of them here in Ireland.
We do. We have about 1,400 species, I think, is the latest estimate. And we've got micro moths, which we can barely see with our naked eye. And then we've got some of the really big moths, like the elephant hawk moths, and pink patterns and the most incredible colours. And moths have evolved to adapt to every niche in Ireland. So you've got some that live in grassy meadows. You've got some that live exclusively in the canopy of a birch tree in the summertime. So the diversity of moths here is just mind-boggling. And of course, they're pollinators too. Bees tend to get all the credit as pollinators, but butterflies and moths are also quite good pollinators. And yeah, they're a massively crucial part of our ecosystems.
Tell me about lucky ladybirds.
Lucky ladybirds. Ladybirds are associated with good luck in medieval Europe because they eat the pests of crops. So it was a really good association to have ladybirds. So now that's why you see a ladybird crawling on your hand and you say it's good luck. We all have this long association of ladybirds as being lucky, and we love them. We see them on school bags and pencil cases and all sorts of things like that because they're celebrated, which is kind of unusual for a beetle. They are beetles. We tend not to like beetles, but ladybirds.
And carnivorous beetles are that.
They are. They eat aphids. So as well, if you've got ladybirds in the garden and maybe you've got roses as well that get attacked by aphids, the more ladybirds you have, the better off you'll be for eating all the aphids or the green fly from your rose bushes.
And I love the Irish name, Boeing Day.
That's right. That's the, it translates as God's little cow.
Yeah. Autumn time is a great time for mushrooms, and you talk a lot about them in the book.
Mushrooms are the fruiting bodies of fungi. So in the same way that we'd have blackberries, rose hips or sloes growing on trees, the mushrooms that we see, like the chanterelles or the bracket fungi or the fly agaric, they're the reproductive organs of the fungi as well. And often they'll have symbiotic relationships with the roots of trees. And one that I find so incredible in the autumn, that's what I've written about in the book, is the fly agaric. You know, it's got a fairy tale, red and white, and it's got these spots on it. It's from the Amanita family. And it's a very toxic mushroom, so it's not good for us to eat. And in this way, the reason why it got its name of fly agaric is that people used to take a bit of this fly agaric, leave it on the kitchen table in a saucer of milk, and the flies who would come and eat that milk would promptly die.
And of course, with the fly agaric too, it's hallucinogenic.
That's right. So there's some really quite amazing tales. I mean, we think that back in the days of the Toyne, they would take fly agaric to be even more berserk and crazy as warriors. There's tales of this in Viking times too. And then we know in northern Scandinavia, the Sami people, they would sometimes drink the urine of the reindeer that had eaten the fly agaric.
Yeah.
And that way the toxins are removed so that the people could drink the juice of the fly agaric, processed juice, and their kidneys won't fail, but they will still have these hallucinogenic experiences.
And of course, the term getting pissed originates from drinking the urine of the reindeer. It's incredible.
Yeah, when you start to look into the stories around some of these species, so I like to look at the ecological personality of the species that I'm covering in each piece, but also our cultural associations with them. And that's where you just find out the most interesting tales about us as a human species.
Thank you very much indeed, Terry Flanagan, for that first suggestion. And remember that you'll find the details of all books on our website, rte.ie/Mooney. Next, it's the turn of Aina and Ilana. Aina!
Yes, Derek, this is a book that I wish was out 40 years ago when I was diving under the sea, because this is a book of all of the things that swim around our Irish coast. It's called Beneath Irish Seas, The Hidden Wonders of Ireland's Amazing Marine Life, and it's written by Nigel Mateer, and it's published by Merriam Press. Now, what he has done is he's gone around the coast of Ireland, all the big famous diving places that we all dive in, and taken pictures of all the creatures that are there underneath the water, which he has gotten in beautiful technicolor and put them all through the book. And they're great. Every page would absolutely lift your heart to see what it is. It's a completely good, positive book. Every page nearly makes you smile. Look at the face of that redfish. Look at that wonderful jellyfish. Look at this thing that looks like wallpaper. The things that live under the ocean are something great. Mind you, he did lug down great big colourful lights in order to get it all in glorious colour. It doesn't quite look like that when you're down there yourself. A point I brought up with him when I was speaking to him earlier.
Firstly, thank you for having me on the programme. And yes, it did take a while. I've been taking pictures. I learned to dive in the mid-80s, and I took up underwater photography shortly thereafter. And I've been taking pictures for a long time. But a lot of the pictures in the book have been taken in the last 5 or 6 years, you know, broadening out the portfolio to areas where I wanted to cover in more detail.
Ah, but you're cheating. You're cheating.
Am I cheating?
You're cheating. You are. Because, you know, I go down, I'm in the wetsuit, have my mask down, I go, I'm like any other creature under the water, and I don't see all the colours you have in your book. Because, as you know, the wavelengths from the sun, they drop off very quickly as they come, the light lengths as they go into the water. So things look red on land because they reflect the red light. But the red light is the first of the wavelengths to vanish in the water. It's gone by 5 metres. And the further down you go, the more they go until about 30 metres down, there's only blue and that's it. And yet you have things with red and yellow and all these colours on them way down deep that you wouldn't see with your own eyes. You can get these pictures because you're bringing down the full spectrum with a great big lamp, lighting them up and getting these wonderful images. Account for yourself.
That's true. The water eats the light, and so you have to bring down flash units. Not unlike on land, you know, you're using flash units on land for photography. You do the same underwater, and that helps you see the actual colour. So you're not putting any colours in that weren't there. You're just showing, being able to show the colour in its real life. And I think that's the thing that surprises people. When people pick up that book, they will see a world of colour that they don't expect to see around our shores in Ireland. And the feedback I've got from the book since it's been published has been, you know, is this really Ireland? I can't believe this is how colourful it is underwater in Ireland. And I think that's the message that I wanted to give to people, was it is extraordinarily colourful around Ireland, and the reefs and seas around our coast are full of the most extraordinary marine life, and we just don't see it. And hopefully by flicking through the pages of this book, it gives people an opportunity to see this really rich environment.
And I'm always curious as to why the colour is there, because the animals down there don't see it either. So why is something at 100 feet, 30 metres, and it's green in colour, but, you know, you don't see it unless you have light? The other creatures don't see it either. So what good is it having all this colour, one animal showing off to another? It's only we only see it when we bring down the full spectrum. So what's the ecological advantage of all of this?
Well, it's hard to tell. You know, like, we don't know, for example, if the animals down there see with the same wavelengths as we do. So they may see it slightly differently. I'm red-green colourblind, Enna, so I don't see the pictures the same colour as you'll see them. So we don't know that they are in the same situation. And there's a picture in the book of a bright red scorpion fish, and it's sitting on kind of reddy brown algae on the seabed. In reality, when you look at that, when I look at that, that scorpion fish sits there and is invisible. It's exactly the same colour as the weed it's sitting on. But when you put light on it, it brings back that colour that you would see if you were holding it in your hand on the seashore. But it's underwater, it's exactly the same colour as the background it's sitting on.
I know, it's amazing. It really is. Now, the other law of physics that I think you have broken as well, and it's very exciting, is how you get these split-level photographs. I'm looking at your seals that you have around Dalkey Island. And as you, of course, as you know, light going through the air and light going through water works in a different way. If you look at a straw and a glass, it looks bent at the interface. And yet, you have them looking right. You actually have an underwater bit in focus and you have the thing up in the air in focus. How did you do that?
The cameras I use are land cameras. They're normal land cameras, but I put them in waterproof housings, and the fronts of those housings are interchangeable, and I use different ports to shoot the lens through. And those split-level shots are taken with a big domed front on the port on the camera. And so I can put a wide-angle lens behind that, and the lens is so wide that I can take in what's above the water if I hold it at the surface, what's above the water and what's below the water.
And it really is effective because you get actually the land. I mean, you have Dalkey Island behind the seal in focus, and the seal, and then under the water is in focus as well. I thought they were super. They're great pictures. I really enjoyed looking at those. And I was looking at a picture there you have now of the sunfish. Are you seeing fishes and creatures from warmer waters around our shores now that wouldn't have been there when you took up diving in the 1980s, or me even earlier in the 1970s?
Yeah, undoubtedly. The water around our shores are warming, and you can see Mediterranean species now are starting to occur around our shore. You can often see red mullet, for example, in the coves, in the sandy coves on the west coast of Ireland, and that's a Mediterranean species, and increasingly on the south coast of England, they're seeing you know, different shrimp species that they would see in the Mediterranean. So as the seas around our shores get warmer, animals are able to kind of exist that didn't exist noticed here before, which on one hand is great, but it does mean that the animals that prefer the colder water are being pushed further and further north, and that can be a problem.
It's great to see how clear the Irish water is. I remember when we swam in Dublin Bay in the early 1970s. You got into the water, you put your hand out in front of you as far as you put your length of your arm, and you couldn't see your fingers. There was that much suspended matter in Dublin Bay before they built the sewage works. You have lovely clear pictures even in Dublin Bay, because the waters have been greatly cleared by the amount of control there is over discharges into the waters. So you get great depth in your pictures as a consequence of this, because the water is so clear.
Like, underwater photography is hard because the water is sometimes not clear, you know. And but you're right. Dublin Bay has a number of big rivers that run into it. So if there's a lot of rain and the rainwater runs into the rivers and then runs into the bay, then the bay can be difficult to photograph in. But one of the beauties about Ireland is, you know, although the water might be murky, there's an enormous amount of life that murky water is sustaining. And then the further west you go, over to the west of Ireland, you can see extraordinarily clear water, like up around Donegal, Mayo and parts of Kerry and the Connemara coasts. You know, on occasion you can see water there that's 40 metres clear. You can be down at the bottom at 40 metres and see up and see the sun on the surface. And those are magical days when you're diving, just wonderful times to be out in the water.
Yeah, it's great. Remember going in off Skellig, when you could go out to Skellig without having to book it 3 years in advance, and going in off the boat with Des Lavelle when we pulled in. It's 40 metres off the boat there, because it was one of the places you had to go for the deep dives. And the fella that was with me, we had to dive for 5 or 5 minutes, came back. And when he came up, he'd left his watch behind down below. It had fallen off. And sure, anyway, Lavelle was going home. That was it. So we came out the next day and looked over the edge with our masks on, and he could see the watch. There was a good big, you know, colourful big diving watch. He could see it down at the bottom. So then we had to go again to get his watch back. So there was great clarity at that time off Skellig. But listen, I'm looking at your lovely peacock worm. Now, these are for the people who need to buy the book and have a look. It's like a stalk covered in stones, and then sticking out of the top is this wonderful fan of colour, and it's what the peacock worm does. It sticks up all these tentacles and waves them around in the current. Now, they are absolutely so hard to see, because any movement in the current made by big lumbering divers with fins and things, and whoosh, they're gone. How did you get him to stay out for your picture? You must have been a bit near to it.
Well, I think one of the skills you have to develop as an underwater photographer is you have to be able to lie really still, because as you say, the animals sense you're there. Any movement in the water at all, they feel it, and if they're at all nervous, they'll disappear. They'll either retract into a hole or disappear, swim away. So being comfortable and calm in the water is a really important skill to be able to get good pictures. And I remember taking that picture, and every so often the worm would disappear back into that tube, and you'd have to sit and wait. And wait for a long time for it to come back out. But when it does, it's well worth it. And while I was waiting, that little goby that you see at the bottom of the tube just arrived, sat there for a few seconds. I took a picture and off it went.
Oh yeah, the pictures are gorgeous, this, and the ones of the basking sharks and all that stuff down in West Clare. But listen, there's no point in talking about a book with lovely pictures. People have to go out and buy it for Christmas. It's the real thing to have sitting in your armchair on Stephen's Day, looking at all those wonderful pictures and planning what you're going to do for 2026. I really have to commend you on such a lovely, lovely book. If you never put on a pair of bathing dogs, you still would enjoy the waters around our coast. Great to talk to you, Nigel. Good night, we laugh.
Many thanks, Aina.
And details of Aina's book also on the website rte.ie/Mooney. Niall Hatch is next. Niall, what have you got for us as a Christmas filler?
Well, it's another great photo book. This one concentrates more on the land and the situation above the water, although there's lots of water in it. It's called On the Edge of Europe, Kerry, and it's by Valerie O'Sullivan, who's a very skilled photographer. We've had her on the programme before. I'm a big fan of her work, especially her natural history photographs. And this book contains lots of natural history photographs, lots of plants and animals, especially birds, but lots of other things too. Kerry has so much to offer, and this really is a love letter to Kerry.
The book took almost 5 years to complete, on and off, you know, and with lockdown and everything kind of combined. And then on Christmas Day, I had an awkward fall, and I was forced to sit down at the computer, compile it together and caption it and lay it out, having broken my shoulder and humerus bone. So that was 4 months putting it together. Other than that, I don't think I'd have succeeded in doing this at all.
You must have had a lot of images to go through, because this book is absolutely packed with photographs, and every single one of them is of the highest standard. It's one of the most attractive photography books that I've ever seen, and it covers a lot of beautiful places, a lot of culture, a lot of human heritage, a lot of natural heritage. And basically, that's Kerry in a nutshell, isn't it?
It is, really. It's I always say, you know, we're the furthest, the highest, the tallest, because we're on the edge of Europe. And, you know, when someone says that it has to be the highest grotto in Ireland, can you see any other grotto higher than 947 metres on Crookfour? You know, and where you have a man called Tommy O'Sullivan, and he was a zealot in terms of his devotion to Our Lady, and he gathered the rocks up on the top of Crookfour, and it's a notorious ridge, and he built his grotto up there and took water up in sandbags, of all things, from Loch Comina Peista, you know, where the aeroplane went down, and he built his grotto there. But he was posthumously honoured this summer in Cronin's Yard, which was really nice 50 years later.
What I really like about this book, well, one of the many things I like, is the way that you managed to blend the ancient and the modern, the traditional and the more contemporary, the different beliefs that have been through Kerry for millennia. So there's a lot of Christianity in there, the monastery and the monastic ruins and remains on Skellig Vihil, for example, to mention just one. But also then the monoliths, the old prehistoric standing stones from the Neolithic people. I find that, you know, it's amazing to think that kind of culture, that kind of human tradition has been in Kerry for a very long time.
Yeah, and we've honoured it before. It was kind of, you know, it's all the rage or whatever, you know, and there's a reawakening, which is wonderful. But we did it naturally. And, you know, take, for instance, the city Shrone, which is the only, one of the oldest pagan, or, you know, places of pilgrimage from pagan to Christian times. It's one of the oldest in continuance. And then directly across then from the city of Shrone, you have the Paps of Anu, and they're the, you know, on the eastern one she's buried, and there's, you know, two nodules on the top that resemble the woman's breasts. And, you know, we were very good at creating women goddesses way back when, and it's, we, you know, when you see the world now, women are fighting for their rights, but back then Anu was the goddess of fertility and agriculture, and, you know, there was that lovely blend of cultures. And Chris, on winter solstice, there's a gang of us go up, and you know, it's said that the Irish were always great for pilgrimages and gatherings. And, you know, naturally, at the top of the Paps of Anu, somebody has a box and we all do a set dance. And, you know, you have the local landowners and just people from all the different areas, and people come from all, were coming from all over the country. And for this blend of madness and hilarity and everyone roaring and screaming, we brought Sam Maguire up there another time. But for the solstice, when we do it for charity, but we're going to do it on St. Bridget's Day this year to blend Anu and Bridget together. It just happens naturally as a day, as a morning, often a bit of crack and humour, you know. But people would say that Anu is happy today, you know, and it's just a given that that everyone acknowledges them. And you know, you look out every morning, and to the east are the Paps, and behind then is Killarney National Park. And we know we're all blessed with what we have in front of us, you know, and behind us and between us.
You mentioned Killarney National Park there, and I think that is one of my favourite sections in your book, because you showcase some of the remarkable wildlife, but also some of the amazing vistas that you have within that park. In terms of the wildlife, by the way, I'm certainly hoping that we would see some of your photographs of the white-tailed eagles, because some of the finest photographs of white-tailed eagles in Ireland that I've ever seen are yours, and I'm pleased to say that they are in there and they look absolutely splendid. But I'm particularly taken by the pictures you have of the red deer stags with the famous rutting and bellowing that happens there in Killarney National Park. Was that difficult to photograph? Were they cooperative? Did you have to spend a lot of time trying to get the perfect shot?
Well, I suppose, you know, you never think you have the perfect shot. But about 2 years ago, everybody was talking about this famous monarch, or the Grand Master is what Peter O'Toole calls him, the Grand Master. But he's actually a monarch, and possibly one, this guy in particular was one of the biggest stags that have been in the national park for a long, long time. And everyone was talking about him, and we, you know, and there was one in the lowlands, but I wanted to go to the highlands because, you know, up Mangerton, you know, where they're in continuance for 10,000 years. So I happened to be up Mangerton doing another job, and the next thing I could hear this big, huge bellowing, and I went, geez, that must be him. So I phoned Joe Huggart, who's you know, the Lake Hotel, and he's big into, you know, we're big into the wildlife stuff. And I said, I think he's around here somewhere. And I just looked over to my left, and there he was. And I only had a shorter lens on, but he was that. We kind of looked at each other, and I just stood there, and he stood there. But I think I got 10 seconds of video, and maybe about 10 shots of him. And then he just drifted off then, like, you know. But that was the monarch, and I think I waited all my life for him.
It certainly was very effective. It's a very, very striking set of images there. Another very striking set of images are from another of my favourite places in Kerry, which I'm almost ashamed to say I only visited for the first time ever this year, and that's Skellig Mhíle, which is absolutely stunning. I've often said that you know, a lot of people take pictures of puffins and they all look the same. You've managed to get a picture of a puffin that's really unique. It's one that's jumping up off the ground, it looks like. It's quite comical, but sort of captures that sort of, I suppose, playfulness and that clown-like ability or perception that we have of puffins. How long did you spend out on Skellig to get those shots?
God, over the years, you know, I probably would visit Skellig Mhíle probably 3 to 4 times in the season, you know. And I was working closely with John Crowley in UCC, and they were putting together the kind of the definitive book of the Skelligs. And you know, it was kind of like a pet project, and, you know, I used to go out there and I'd say, John, I might have this, that, and we, you know, discovered new steps. And, you know, I said, I'm after speaking with Brian Power, who's the, or you probably know Brian, of course, the ornithologist out there. And I had photographed a few of the puffins, and I said, you know, there are tags on some of these, and I'll relay them back to you. And one of them was 27 years old, and then he had come across one that was already tagged in 1991, and it reappeared again, you know, in 2023. So, you know, over 27 years old, which is incredible. So we were able to, you know, and to think that every year the puffins come back year after year after year. But they're the cutest things in the world. I love them.
Me too. And you've captured them perfectly. And you've captured the kingdom itself perfectly. I think that for anybody who has any interest in natural history or in Ireland or in beautiful photographs or even beautiful writing, because you write beautifully about your photographs, this is a must purchase, I think. It's one of the best books I've seen in a long time. So congratulations, Valerie. I think it's a real great achievement, and I highly recommend it.
Thank you so much. And when you're in Kerry the next time, we'll meet up. We'll take you out to the site of the eagles.
It's a deal.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much indeed, Niall Hatch. Now, The Living and the Dead, Tales of Loss and Rebirth from Irish Nature by Conor W. O'Brien, explores vanished species and the hopeful return of others, blending history and ecology with vivid storytelling. This is Richard Collins' suggestion.
Hello, Connor. It's said that something like 99% of all the animals that ever existed are extinct, and that the rate of extinction is accelerating. Now, Ireland is not immune from the process, and your book sets out the state of affairs in the recent past and just now. Outline it for us, would you, Connor?
Absolutely, Richard. Well, I mean, I've always been interested in extinct wildlife, which is why I chose to start the book in the Natural History Museum in Dublin, where, you know, you have this amazing catalogue of species that we have and species that we once had. So I thought with this book it would be an interesting project to look at some of the species that we used to have in Ireland and that have unfortunately been lost to us over the last couple of hundred years, when we've seen the impact of man really take its toll on the natural world through things like hunting, through habitat loss, etc. But also I wanted to kind of counteract that by looking at some of the species that we've regained over the last 100 years or so, species that have been reintroduced or that have been saved from the brink of extinction, or in the case of the great spotted woodpecker, that have recolonised Ireland on their own steam. So I just thought it would be an interesting project really to contrast the two, to look at species that we've lost as a consequence of, you know, changes to the natural environment over the last couple of 100 years, but then also really to provide hope and to celebrate some of the efforts that are being done to help resuscitate our wild spaces and to help rewild the country as much as we can.
Connor, you mentioned many casualties. That's about 14 different species. They are not all extinct. Only some of them are extinct. Some of them have come back from the dead. It's a mixed bag, the living and the dead, as the book's title says. Now, one of them, which intrigues me, is the sturgeon. The sturgeon is the famous caviar fish. And we don't normally associate it with Ireland, but there's a specimen in the Natural History Museum, all right. Can you outline for us something of the sturgeon's past and indeed present in Ireland?
Absolutely. Well, yeah, there's, I suppose, one of the reasons we don't associate it with Ireland anymore is because it's so rare now, really up to the point of extinction. Once upon a time, the sturgeon was considered the royal fish. It was really the meat of the fish was preserved for royalty, hence the royal fish. And all sturgeons that were caught around the Irish coast were initially to be handed over to the King of England. It can be an enormous fish. In fact, it's thought that the adults never stop growing, so they can reach upwards of 2, 3, 4, even 5 metres in the exceptionally old individuals. And it's thought that some of these exceptionally large sturgeon could have even inspired lake monsters or river monsters, of which there are plenty of in Irish waters. But more recent times have not been kind to the sturgeon. There's upwards of 20 species of sturgeon in the world, and all of them are thought to be endangered or threatened to some degree. And the reasons for this are manifold. I mean, pollution of the rivers is one reason. Sturgeon are extremely sensitive to pollution within the water. Blocking off of rivers is another issue that they face. So, you know, when you introduce things like dams, weirs, bridges and various other obstacles, that prevents the sturgeon from migrating upriver to spawn. You also have fishing, and I mean, sturgeon have suffered extensively as a result of bycatch from overfishing. The tragic result of this is that since the late 1980s, they've been effectively extinct from Irish waters. And there was a specimen that was very recently caught off the coast of Valentia Island with much fanfare. But I think really the amount of excitement about that catch really just demonstrates how rare sturgeon have become in Irish waters. And when you look at historical records, they would have been recorded from many of the great major rivers in Ireland. It's thought that they were once caught in the River Shannon, for example, but that hasn't been the case for many generations now. So, an absolutely spectacular creature, one of the most incredible prehistoric species that we once had, barely changed since the time of the dinosaurs, but now tragically all but extinct in Irish waters.
Connor, you raise an interesting proposition, and it is that this legend of the Loch Ness Monster began with the sighting of a very large sturgeon, and they can be very large indeed. Is that plausible, you think?
It's certainly a topic that I've explored in the book. People who have studied that the phenomenon of the lake monsters have said that, you know, when you look at all of the species, of the sightings of which could have inspired them, so species like seals, species like otters, a sturgeon could potentially be one of those that would be most likely to inspire monster sightings. And it certainly fits the criteria. It's a very prehistoric looking creature, heavily armoured back, long pointed, slightly upturned snout. It certainly looks every bit a species that belongs in the Cretaceous period, and indeed has changed very, very little since that time. So you can just imagine like a very large sturgeon kind of cruising along a loch or a river, and then the heavily armoured back, you know, the length of a human being on a fish that's much longer than a human being, breaks the surface of the water really slowly, and people are just like, oh my goodness, what is that, before it disappears beneath the water surface, never to be seen again. You could very easily imagine instances like that leading to inspiration for that there is something undiscovered within the waters around Ireland and indeed elsewhere. It certainly is a possibility that they could be the genesis of some of the monster sightings that have been recorded really since medieval times.
You mentioned that this was the royal fish and the first one caught was sent to the monarch. And now there was an interesting conundrum in Kerry during the reign of Eamon de Valera as president. A sturgeon was caught, but a most amusing history unfolded, which you mentioned. Would you like to outline that for us?
Yes, absolutely. So there was much fanfare in County Kerry in April 1966 when not one but two sturgeons were actually caught and brought into Dingle Harbour on the same day. The first specimen which was brought in actually managed to escape amazingly. So the tradition up until that point was that any sturgeon caught around the Irish coast would be delivered to the monarch in England. But of course, Ireland was a republic at that point and we didn't have a monarch. So people were wondering, OK, well, what do we do then? So the theory was that it should go to the head of state in Ireland, who at the time was President Eamon de Valera. And he decreed that instead of it going to him, it should go to the local Poor Clare nuns instead. But it never managed to actually get that far. A young man who was on the boat heard cries from the dock saying, throw it out, which he thought meant to mean throw the fish out of the boat and into the water, when what was actually intended was to throw it out onto the dock. So he threw this incredibly rare and precious specimen back into the water, and thanks to an incredible misunderstanding, it managed to escape. And as if the story couldn't get even more bizarre and more unusual, another sturgeon was actually landed that very same day. So two incredibly rare sturgeons caught off the same section of Irish coast, really on the same day. Quite incredible. This sturgeon didn't manage to escape. Not entirely certain what happened to it. The gentleman who caught it had previously been interned during the Second World War, so he was not the biggest fan of the current head of state, who he held responsible for that. So he thought instead to sell his sturgeon elsewhere, and it's thought that it eventually might have actually ended up on the banquet table of the royal family in England. So quite an incredible story. Just goes to show that the royal fish couldn't be kept from the table of royalty, even after our transition from being part of Britain into a free republic.
Another creature on the brink is the northern right whale. Now, one of these was sighted off Ireland recently. The right whale is odd. Most of the great whales, the baleen whales, they have all more or less improved their fortunes since the ban on whaling some years ago. And they're all doing reasonably well. Even the blue whale, the largest of all, is increasing in numbers. But the exception has been the right whale. So this whale is very important. It's very interesting that it should be showing up now. Can you outline its story for us too?
The right whale's name, unfortunately, comes from the tradition of whaling. It was considered the right whale to hunt on account of it being a very large whale. Adults could weigh in excess of 50 tons. It was quite a slow-moving species. It was coastal in habit, and it was also very curious by nature, which would mean it would naturally approach boats, which, of course, made it much, much easier to hunt. So all of these factors contributed to make it the right whale to hunt, and it's a species that has really been hunted since the medieval period, when its baleen would have been used for things like crossbows. But in an age of industrial whaling, it was most valued for its oil. And an adult right whale could yield upwards of 20 tonnes of oil, which it was one of the most valuable commodities in the world at the time. Before you had, you know, drilling for oil, a lot of oil came from whales. So this led to extensive commercial hunting of right whales, including in Ireland. You would have had Norwegian whalers setting up a shop off the coast of County Mayo, in Blacksod Bay, and also on the Inishkey Islands. One of the reasons for this is because there was temporary cessation of whaling in Norway, and then the Norwegian whalers needed to find somewhere else where they could hunt, with access to the whaling populations in the North Atlantic. And of course, the west coast of Ireland was ideal for that. So they set up operation on the west coast of Ireland and began hunting a lot of the large baleen whales that could be found there, including the right whale, which could still be found in very small numbers in the early 20th century, moving up and down the Irish coast. There were 18 right whales landed between 1908 and 1910, and thereafter there were basically no right whales confirmed for certain in Irish waters until that individual was seen in 2024. So quite an enormous gap right there. All right whales have basically been protected for quite some time now. But in that time, a new threat has emerged, which is boat collisions. So with all of the boating traffic in the coastal waters of the North Atlantic, that can cause a lot of damage to a really slow-moving and coastal species of whale like the right whale. So tragically, it's still very much a species on the brink. Thought to be fewer than 350 adults in the whole world, only about 70 females of breeding age. So, yeah, really a species that is quite on the brink, and one that still faces a very much uncertain future.
Connor, that is marvellous, and it's a marvellous book, very interesting, full of anecdotes and asides, and you'll learn a lot from reading it, at least I did anyway.
Thank you very much.
And as always, the details can be found on the website rte.ie/Mooney. Now, Michelle Brown, our researcher, and Sinead Renshaw, who's our broadcast coordinator, are in studio, and they're armed with books. Who will we start with? You, Michelle, off you go.
Okay, Derek, I have picked Dinshanachus, Visions of Ireland's Upland, which is published by Home Tree as my book.
Dinshanachus, Cottis Brilishin now.
It means topography, but it also has an old Irish meaning of the lore of a place.
Mm-hmm.
This book is about Ireland's Atlantic uplands in the west coast of Ireland, where communities are suffering depopulation and reduced farm incomes, but also habitat loss because of like wetter and more extreme weather. So this is all about artists, ecologists, communicators going out into communities and looking at sort of practical ways they can kind of sustain the landscape where they're living. Like, you know, lots of different artists doing lots of different projects, and it's a very sort of poetical yet practical kind of booklet.
Now, give me an example of some of the stories in there.
Okay, so one, that John Duffy was born in London. His parents were from Donegal, and he himself worked in oil and gas exploration. But he was always drawn back to Donegal, eventually moved there and set up a future oak farm park with his partner, Laura. And this is all about like farming for nature. So he's saying that the demise of wolf in Ireland really negatively impacted on our forests. It means that herbivores were eating everything up.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to become more like wolves.
Goodness.
Yeah, so he, in our farming practices, so he uses electric fences to bunch his herd and mimic predator-driven behaviour. So there's the right amount of trampling, the right amount of foraging, which triggers germination, the right amount of dung and urination into the microbiome, and allows time and for the land to regenerate as well. So they're the kind of stories that you have throughout.
Who actually published this book?
So it's published by the charity Home Tree, and they're all about sort of sustainability through community. They have lots of landscape restoration projects, and they're based down in Ennistynan. And like, you know, they do things like they collect native Irish seeds and they go out and they plant trees.
And they got a little help from Creative Ireland, I believe.
So this is the Creative Climate Action Fund, which is funded between the Department of Tourism, Culture and Arts, the Department of Environment and Climate, and the Shared Island Fund, Department of the Taoiseach, which are doing very interesting work at the moment.
Very good. What do you really like about it, Michelle?
What I really like about it as well is, and I picked this book for young people because it's all about solutions. It's about getting people actively involved in climate change. It's about how you can roll up your sleeves and go out and help. And also there's an Irish language element. Sort of a lot of people have been drawn to the Irish language at the moment.
Lovely. Thank you very much indeed, Michelle. Now, Sinead, what have you got for us?
Derek, I have chosen Animalopedia. It's the latest in a series of books published by Gill Books and written by John Burke with illustrations by his daughter Kathy. There was Islandopedia, Histopedia, but this one focuses on the flora and fauna that can be found all around Ireland. It was only published a couple of months ago, back in October, mm-hmm. and it's been really, really well received.
Now, it's a big book, Sinead.
It's a huge book. If you imagine two A4 sheets of paper on top of each other, horizontally, if you know what I mean, mm-hmm. it's that sort of size.
It's got lots of very cute illustrations on the cover.
It has. The illustrations are absolutely gorgeous. And it's what I love about it is it's really well designed inside. So there's different chapters looking at the habitats, mm-hmm. the flora, the fauna, all the names of the animals and the plants are written Oscuelga as well as in English. So it's a great way of learning the names in Irish, which is really important to do. There's a key for every animal to tell you more about it. So, for example, the badger, which is broch in Irish, that can be found in forests, in hedgerows. It's a carnivore, it's nocturnal, and it's native to Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
There's a physical description of each animal, its habitat, and other facts and stories about the animal. The illustrations are bright, they're colourful, they're eye-catching, and it's the sort of book that would appeal to both children at the higher end of primary school and secondary school students. But to be honest, anyone who has an interest in nature and wildlife would get something out of it. It really is one of those books that's for everybody.
Now, anything you found interesting, surprising or new?
Oh, so much. It's one of those books. Well, for example, did you know, Derek Mooney, that there is a type of spider called a Jesus spider?
Well, as it happened, Sinead.
Yes,
no,
Derek.
No, I didn't.
Oh, neither did I until I read this book. It's the biggest kind of spider that lives in Ireland's bogs, and it's properly called a raft spider. But it is also known as the Jesus spider because it can walk on water. Appropriately enough.
Wow.
Another one that I found fascinating, the elephant hawk moth, who I know so well, but I've never actually thought about where the name comes from. That is so named because the stripes on the wings resemble an elephant's trunk.
Okay, you learn something new every day.
You
now,
do,
any
indeed.
Particular animal story or page that you enjoyed more than the others?
Oh, I loved from a purely factual thing. The pages on the forest are very good. They describe how there's three different types of forest in Ireland and how the woodlands have the four different layers, the tree, the shrub, the field and the ground. It's very good at breaking stuff down, so it's easy to absorb in an educational way as well as being fascinating.
Now, three different types of forest. Come on, everybody's screaming at the radio. What is she talking about?
A forest is a forest, surely not. No, there are three different types of forest: deciduous, coniferous and mixed.
Mm.
So they're the three different types of forest and the four layers of woodland, in case you were also wondering: tree, shrub, field and ground. So it's very beautifully broken down and analysed in a way that's simple for everybody to get. But there's also fascinating stories. There's one that caught my eye about how a whale carcass inspired the design of our national instrument, the harp, no less.
Did it?
It did. It is said that the wind blowing through the sinews of a whale carcass on a beach inspired the creation of the harp, with the sinews used as strings.
Well, I never knew that. And what's the story about St. Bridget and the oyster catcher?
Well, the Irish name for oyster catcher is Gwilla Vrida, and that means servant of Bridget. So according to legend, St. Bridget was being followed by some men who wanted to kill her. After a long chase, she reached a beach and she collapsed with exhaustion. A flock of oyster catchers saw what was happening and they quickly covered her with a mound of seaweed and she wasn't discovered. St. Bridget blessed the birds, who to this day have a faint cross on their breast.
Anyway, who are you recommending this for, Sinead?
To be honest, I'm recommending it for everybody. I showed it to my 14-year-old daughter to get her take on it, because they sort of, I think it's primarily aimed at upper primary school, lower secondary school children, but it is for everybody. She loved it. She loved the fact that there was pages on horses, which is it's her kind of animal. There is stuff on domesticated animals and on farm animals too. But it's a perfect coffee book for everybody, families, people living alone, whether you have any interest in nature and wildlife, just about what is around us in Ireland. There's something there for everybody. And I have to say, it is one of those books that once you pick it up and you start leafing through, you're not going to put it down for a very long time.
Fantastic. Now, do we have any of these books to give away to our listeners?
So we have got five copies of the book that Sinead has, and she's also got another book here called The Illustrated Encyclopedia of the Irish Sea Shore, which is by Lucy Taylor, who is also, by, as a matter of fact, one of the editors of the Dinshenicus book that I
just mentioned. Oh, very good. All right, OK. And what is the question, Sinead?
The question, Derek, can be found on the website.
You mean you're asking our listeners to do some work?
I am. Go to your computer, go to your phone, type in rte.ie/Mooney. The questionnaire will be there. Five copies of each book and good luck. Perfect Christmas present.
And while you're at your computer, you might want to send a letter to Santa. You haven't got much time left. Have a listen. Hi, Santa. I can't wait for our radio show on Christmas Eve.
Ho, 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 Derek, that's right.
Parents, grandparents and children too.
Tell us your Christmas list and what you're up to.
Send all your letters and family stories
to Santa at rte.ie.
Send your letters by December 8th and include your phone number.
Yes, I'll be calling some boys and girls live from the North Pole.
Ooh, don't miss the Santa Radio Show Christmas Eve at 2:30 on RTE Radio 1 and the RTE Player app. So, just about an hour left for you to get your email to Santa at rte.ie. That's pretty much all we have time for tonight. We'll do it all again next week at the same time. Are you ready, Sinead and Michelle? Here we go. One, two, three, bye!